Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Idle Australians with James and Asha. Idle Australians with James and Asha. Idle Australians with James and Asha. Let's get the show going, boys.
Here we are. All right, what episode is this? I don't even know.
It's the one after the last one we did.
Excellent.
And the one preceding the next one. It doesn't matter. It's not all lineal. Osh, like people dip in and out of podcasts, yeah. Whatever comes in their feed, whatever gets recommended to them by some sort of algorithm in Silicon Valley. People don't care about numbers or details, or they don't even know what the name of the podcast is. They're just like, oh, that's something that's in front of my face right now. I'll scroll down on it. Maybe I'll click on it. And this is what you've clicked on. This is what you have scrolled and clicked on, and now it is in your face and in your ear. So welcome. Welcome to episode whatever's in your feed like right now. I mean, that's how people watch Netflix these days.
It's like,
you know, I watched a friend of mine scroll through Netflix for longer than he watched of the actual show that he discovered.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that is the show, just scrolling.
I remember in the States when I lived in America, there was the TV Guide channel, which just scrolled a TV guide.
Have you ever been so lonely or slash high or slash drunk that you've discovered on Netflix the Burning Log show? It's just a Burning Log.
Stop right
there. I reckon
there.
You could bring it up now.
I'll be back in 2 hours.
It is 2 to 4 hours of a Burning Log. That's it.
How are you feeling today, James? We had a big day. We went to the mothership.
Usher, wait a minute.
Yeah, what?
The Burning Log rates higher than 90% of the shows that I've been on. I'm outrated by a Burning Log.
I think most of us are, really. But I think, I work on TV shows that are outrated by a 9-year-old kid unboxing things.
Oh, God, you can't compete with him.
Nah. It makes $80 million a year. It's like,
that guy's a powerhouse. Yeah. I mean, but how? I mean, just the way he unboxes, though.
Yeah. It's a joy of discovery every day on YouTube. Today was a good day, James. We went to the mothership. We went to Channel 10 and we talked about this show. And we were on telly together, which doesn't happen. Happens every now and again. The last time that was when you worked on that Survivor show. I think that was the last time we did it.
Yeah, but prior to that, I don't think we'd been on television together for a good decade. But now here we are together.
Yeah.
I mean, but nobody's filming. We should film this.
I am.
Oh. Are you really filming this?
Yeah.
No, this is terrible. I haven't done my, you know, I'm barely wearing pants.
You haven't done your beauty routine.
Welcome to the show. It's, of course, Idle Australians. It's all about the unsung heroes and untold stories of this wide brown land. We've been going deep over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
And this episode is no different because we're talking to someone who I think changed the world.
Hold on there, Jimmy. Let me walk you through. Let me walk you towards that. How are you, Jimmy? How are you and I talking to each other today?
Well, are we going to break the illusion?
We're going
to
pull back the curtain.
People like the idea that we're sitting next to each other, that we're at your place, chilling in your pad.
How are we? How am I also in your home, and how are you in my home?
Are you talking about the technology?
Yeah.
Like you're on the internet. I'm on the internet. We're connected via the internet. We're on Zoom. If people want to know, we're on Zoom. We're not in the same room. Often we are.
Yeah, often
not
we are.
Tonight, though.
And my laptop is not plugged into the modem. How is your laptop plugged into the modem?
No.
How
it's not.
How's the signal getting from your laptop to the modem?
I'm on my network. I'm in my Wi-Fi network.
And a quick question, very important question. What's the name of your Wi-Fi network?
Sex Dungeon. No, wait, that's my neighbor.
Ours is pretty it's husband and Wi-Fi.
Oh, that's good. Make Wi-Fi great again.
That's great. That's a great network name. Do you remember what it was like before Wi-Fi?
I'm trying to think if that was ever a thing for me. I remember we used to have an old computer and I probably ran an Ethernet cable into the back of it and then another cable into something else.
That's
I think a lot of Ethernet cables pumped into one another.
I remember going like I had a long lead from Tandy Electronics that I would because the only internet computer I knew was the one at work at the radio station I worked at, and I would plug it in the newsroom and then run the cable under the two doors and into the studio because I did the overnight shift, and I would put the computer in the I'd have to drag this computer into the studio so I could have access to the internet while I was on the radio with this 42-meter long cable. But there was a time before Wi-Fi, and to get to a life before Wi-Fi, if you can imagine life without Wi-Fi, it's bananas, right?
Yeah.
Like how many times today did you use it?
I open up my laptop. It finds it automatically. I'm online. I'm on the internet.
Yeah.
Wherever I am.
There's things in my house that are connected to Wi-Fi. We had a baby crib that was connected to Wi-Fi, for goodness sakes.
The crib's connected to Wi-Fi?
Yeah. We could control how much it rocked Wolfie to sleep off our phones.
That is amazing.
It was.
It's kind of lazy, but I get it. You're tired. You're exhausted.
To get to a life before Wi-Fi, Jimmy, we have to go back in time, but actually quite a way back longer than most people think. We have to go back over 100 years to 1916. Now, this is when the Australian government formed the Council of Science and Industry, which the very first thing they did with a grant of £250 from Queensland and New South Wales, they set to work on trying to eradicate prickly pear, which was a weed that was decimating millions of acres of agricultural land in Eastern Australia. State of origin time, Queensland, New South Wales, mortal enemies. But when it comes to prickly pear, united.
Oh, yeah. It's a common enemy.
They did it with a bit of a help from a little moth that was brought in from South America. And the moth that ate the prickly pear has the best Latin name ever, I think. But it does make me think, like, you know, when you're kind of naming insects, they must just have been taking the piss by this point. What are we going to call the moth that eats the prickly pear? And then give it a Latin-sounding name. What do you reckon, Colin? I know. Cactoblastus cactorum, because it fucking blasts the cactus.
Blast the cactus.
Nice one, Colin.
There you go. And that was the first thing that, who's this mob again?
The Council of Science and Industry. But they kind of developed up and then they helped out the primary industries and the military a fair bit across World War II. They helped them build radar. But in 1949, they did two important things. One, they stopped working for the military. And two, they added an RO to their name. And they became the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, the CSIRO. And it was around 1949, Jimmy, that our hero was born, Dr. John O'Sullivan, who, despite being a stellar hockey player at Sydney University, he graduated from there with a PhD in electrical engineering.
Small and portable. This is the future of business communications. And as portable computers become more widespread as business tools, there is an increasing need for wireless connectivity.
He's rubbing shoulders with giants there at Sydney Uni. Some of the alumni include 7 Australian Prime Ministers, 4 opposition leaders, 24 High Court justices, and one, Dolph Lundgren.
Dolph Lundgren went to Sydney Uni?
He holds a master's degree in chemical engineering from Sydney University.
There's a point where you think, I can't love Dolph anymore. Like, my Dolph love is maxed out. And then you hear shit like that. And
the Universal Soldier himself.
I mean, that is probably peak Dolph Lundgren, Universal Soldier. I mean, people enjoyed He-Man.
It was pretty good.
What about Ivan Drago? He was Ivan Drago, right?
Well, he was. And it's kind of interesting because it all started while he was here in Sydney. He became Grace Jones's bodyguard when she spotted him on the door of a nightclub while she was here in Sydney. Because he was the 1981 European karate champion,
and obviously quite tall, hot and smart, they started rooting pretty instantly. She convinced him to move to New York, got him a job in the James Bond movie, A View to a Kill, and then boom, Rocky IV. Even though, James, even though it wasn't the theme song for Rocky IV, in March 2010, at the finale of Melodi Festivalen, which is a little like the group qualifier for Eurovision, you know, before they go to the main game,
mm-hmm.
Dolph Lundgren, TV host Christine Meltzer, and Måns Zelmerlöw came out in the grand finale. It's kind of like Australian Idol, but for, you know, they came out and they sang Eye of the Tiger.
Go, Dolph.
That's Christine. She's another TV host. Guess which one won Swedish Idol?
Probably old mate here.
Yeah, I think you're right. But anyway, that was a beautiful moment of Dolph Lundgren there that I thought you'd enjoy. But back to our hero, John Sullivan, not a great singer, but as far as I know, excellent with radio telescopes. He developed some world-leading CSIRO radio telescopes, you know, designed to look at the stars and look at other planets and exoplanets around Australia. But then in 1974, John moved to the Netherlands to the De Vinglo Radio Observatory. Now, I'm just wondering, a young engineer from Sydney, what does he make of the Netherlands in 1974? Because let's not forget, Jim, what was special about the Netherlands in 1974?
Tulips.
It was a very, very important sporting event that happened in 1974, and the Netherlands were transformative at that sporting event.
Did they win the World Cup?
They created the concept of total football, Jimmy.
Ah, Johan Cruyff.
That's exactly right.
Yes, of course.
They went all the way. They hadn't qualified in nearly 40 years for the World Cup, and they played total football. What's total football? I remember you tried to explain it to me once.
Did I? Oh, well, that would have bored you shitless.
Oh, I was really interested.
I mean, I think prior to that stage, you had very defined positions in football. You know, if you're a striker, you're a striker. If you're a centre-back, you just hung at the back and you made sure that no goals were scored, you know. But Cruyff was like, no, we're all footballers. We can all dribble. We can all pass. You know, the idea of set, defined roles that we stick to rigidly, let's throw that out the window, you know. Your right and your left back, they can become wing backs. They can force their way up so that they can have an extra man overlapping and sending the crosses in. And, you know, if you want to push forward as a center midfield, then someone else will drop back for you. Playing as a complete team, not bound by these imaginary positions that are titles and they're a guide for where you should be on the field. But, you know, it's not netball. You've got to stay in this zone. So, yeah, Cruyff sort of pioneered that way of thinking.
Exactly. And that's what total football was. And let's just say inspired by the Dutch and their total football. In 1977, he co-authored a paper, and apparently this paper directly led to the creation of Wi-Fi. This human being, this man, this legend who created a product, a thing that you, that me, everyone listening to this, they probably downloaded this podcast over Wi-Fi, is using today. James, I'm very happy to say we have him.
Oh, boy.
We have the man, the myth, the legend, the winner of the 2009 Prime Minister's Prize for Science, the European Inventor of the Year, 2012, the man who helped a team of scientists break on through to the other side of 100 megabits a second Wi-Fi, James Matheson. Welcome to Wide All Australians, Dr. John O'Sullivan.
He really, really pumped up your tires there, John, didn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know, Jimmy. Over 3 billion devices on the planet use something that he had a part of working on. It's pretty decent to give him a bit of warm air.
Oh, yeah. It's all right. It's all right, I guess, you know. I mean, it's not the Hills Hoist, is it? But, you know, it's not the polymer banknote, but it's good. It's good. Let's be honest, John.
I can do the quiet achiever bit if you like.
Amazing to have you on the show, John. It is a show about sort of untold stories. And I think, you know, for most of us, Wi-Fi is something that we use every single day without giving it a second thought. But there was a time when it didn't exist. And, you know, the only way to connect to your network or get online or connect to a device was plugging in a cable. Isn't that right?
Well, it was even worse than plugging in a cable, actually, back in the time. You actually had this thick cable running around. And if you want to put a new position in it, you had to actually drill a hole through the side of the cable and put a probe in and mount a box that was about 10 centimetres long over the cable. It was quite a hassle. And come to think of it, the portable computers weren't all that flash either.
Speaking of drills, John, we actually invented the electric drill.
Oh, really?
Not obviously Osh and I, but yeah, that is an Australian invention.
I don't,
the electric drill.
Build a lot of houses, but has it brought as much joy to as many people as Wi-Fi, James? I don't know.
No, yeah, probably not. And so why was that a problem? I mean, obviously technology, often it's about trying to innovate and create solutions for things that, you know, obviously can be improved. But why was that a problem? Why did it become something that we needed to try and find a solution for? Because I imagine because it was how everything operated, why did we think that there was a way forward there?
I guess we came to it, I'm about to say slowly, but it actually happened over a relatively short time. And we were looking at things, we're in a research environment, so we were using things like these wired networks, and through those wired networks you could access data banks, and you could see things like email. We also were experimenting with the use of portable computers or luggable computers. So you could start to see where things might be going. But at the time, there were wireless networks, but they were pretty slow. So we started to think, what if you could actually wirelessly connect at the same speed as the best wired networks, which were actually fiber optic at the time, but, you know, they were 100 megabits per second. And as you started to think about it, and we had, you know, various people in CSIRO and our collaborators that were, you know, thinking about these problems, and we started to think, well, you know, once you got up to, you know, towards 100 megabits per second, you could ship video, you could imagine, you know, technician working in the inside of an aircraft or something, being able to bring up the manual over what they should be doing on this part, all sorts of things. We decided to go for the doctor, as it were, set ourselves a challenge that was as fast as the best wired network.
From what I understand, when you're dealing with a radio signal like this, echoes are a real problem, but I had no idea. Like in this studio, I'm talking into a microphone. I've got these sound buffers on the wall so my voice doesn't bounce around. Do echoes cause a problem when you're dealing with this kind of signal?
Absolutely. And that's where we came at the problem. As soon as you start to think about 100 megabits, if you send them one after another, the bits are only 3 meters apart. So if they bounce off the wall behind you and come back, they're going to, you know, the echo of the last bit or the last 20 bits or so or 100 bits is just going to confuse the heck out of you. So, you know, we pretty quickly realized we had to do something about the echoes. And it was partly because of the way we went about trying to understand what the echoes would do. And we were interested, we were quite used to thinking both in the time and also in the frequency or pitch or tones, whatever. And, you know, as we thought more about the problem, gradually ways of solving it became possible.
Can you, like, paint a picture for me? Like, it's you and a team of other scientists and engineers, and have you got a lab? Do you sit down at a lunch table? Are you spitballing ideas? You got a chalkboard up there? Like, how are you sharing ideas and picking each other's brains? Are you heading to the pub for a few pints? What are you doing?
Yeah, I didn't find the pub work too well for me. I couldn't really concentrate. But we did, we were part of a division of CSIRO that had a proud history. And, you know, had number five computer in the world. It had research on the first transistors going on. It was called radio physics, which was code in during World War II for radar. The dish at Parkes and the dishes at Narrabri were, you know, developed by this group in CSIRO. So it had lots of smart people. And so we were thinking also, we need to bring a lot of these smart people from different areas together and work on one problem that has some real commercial opportunities. And by bringing people with different skills together, you know, we can attack a problem that you couldn't do in the solitary scientist mode.
How did you guys kind of navigate a bottleneck? What was the problem-solving strategies that you used?
Fairly quickly, we started to, oh, wait a minute, what if we treat the problem quite differently? What if we not try and send the bits one after another, but we give each bit a different tone? And we start to think down these paths, and then each time you sort of solve a problem, you sort of expose the next problem. And, yeah, there were different people thinking about it, and yeah, it was an interesting team effort. You know, mathematician, physicist, couple of radio and system engineers, software engineer, and you know, various other people and collaborators.
Is it, you mentioned inspiration about trying to solve problems. Is it true that Dr. Stephen Hawking provided inspiration for what we now know as Wi-Fi?
So Stephen Hawking, one of the interesting things about astronomy was you're encouraged to reach for the stars, as it were. You know, we had these astronomers, and I was sort of an astronomer, but more the instrumentalist. But a couple of the astronomers came to me in the Netherlands and said, look, Stephen Hawking and Martin Rees, the astronomer royal, Lord Rees of Ludlow, I believe he was in the UK, had this idea that black holes, as they get smaller and smaller, black holes for a start, aren't entirely black. As they get smaller and smaller, they get hotter. And finally, they get so small and so hot that they might go up with something like a nuclear explosion. They were suggesting that maybe that nuclear like explosion would result in a radio pulse, just the same as the electromagnetic pulse that people were terrified about with nuclear bombs. And maybe, just maybe, you could see these pulses from little mini black holes going bang all around us, left over from the Big Bang. And so we set out trying to measure these pulses, didn't find anything, but it aroused a lot of interest. And we came back some years later with much more comprehensive equipment, able to detect pulses smeared out by using the different frequency tones in the signal. As part of that, I came away thinking there has to be a better way. Can we do one of the operations here? Can we do it digitally rather than with a big optical light table full of lasers and other stuff? Could we do it in a digital chip? So we got the chance to do that, and it's hard to say. Other people may have come up with similar ideas to the ones we had, but we knew it was possible to do. It wouldn't take a room full of equipment. It could be done in a computer chip, or at least it could be in a few years' time. These things take time. So, yeah, you know, the inspiration from trying to do that experiment that was sort of initiated by Stephen Hawking's incredible thoughts did in an indirect way lead us to part of the solution to the high-speed Wi-Fi problem.
So you come up with this digital idea and then you can do it out of a chip, but the technology is not quite there yet. Is that correct?
Yes, we could see it could be done. Mm. Moore's law would say the speed of chips doubles every year and a half, something like that. The amount of memory doubles in the same sort of time scale. So we could project, yeah, okay, that's only a few years ahead when you could do this. It turned out it was more like about 10 years. But we did, in fact, some of our collaborators from Macquarie University, Dave Skellen and Neil Westy, started a company. I joined that company, and we actually produced the first chips to actually implement this new Wi-Fi standard. And that was just about the same time as the Sydney Olympics, 10 years later.
Often any challenge that you set your mind to, and obviously we can't speak to what it's like to be a scientist, but whenever you're trying to solve a problem or dealing with a complicated issue at work or a project, there's a large percent of your brain that can't switch off, that's thinking about that problem 24/7, you know, during the day, when you get home, as you lie in bed at night. Was that the sort of thing that was happening for you at the time? Was it just a constant flood of ideas and what ifs and perpetual spinning of those wheels upstairs?
Yeah, I think my wife would say yes with resoundingly. Certainly, you know, certainly sometimes you go to bed grappling with a problem and you wake up in the morning with a sort of a solution. There are other times you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, I thought of something last night. I wonder what it was. Yeah, I think some of the key problems were not solved by me. They were solved by other members of the team, I have to say. And I look at my notebooks and I think, gee, I was going down some blind alleys there too, wasn't I? But, you know, I think that's part and parcel of any of this.
But that it's really it. And hearing you say that is really important for people to understand that you don't just go, I have an idea, I've discovered it, hooray. It's finding the things that don't work that gets you one step closer to the things that do. Was there any point that you kind of lost heart and you thought, I'm never going to get this done?
I think at a later stage, we tried to get partners, commercial partners, interested in this. And the early 90s turned out to be a bad time in the computer world. There were mass layoffs in some companies. And we ended up a couple of years there sitting relatively idle. And then it picked up later as I had left CSIRO.
When you look around now, John, and you see that, like Gosh said, it's in 3 to 5 billion devices around the world and it's ubiquitous in our daily lives, what is it like to reflect on that, being involved in a technology that virtually everyone on the planet uses on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously some pride, but I look back and we were arguing with various people trying to say this is going to be big, but what we thought was big and what we now see is so, so different. We mainly saw sort of business applications, education applications, but every little device now has got a Wi-Fi interface in it. It's just amazing how we've just become so dependent on it.
When you think about the way it could have gone, what kind of environment do you think that you had at work as far as were they, look, here's the funding, you guys are clearly onto something, off you go and go and play, or were there people above you wanting reports all the time and, you know, the funding needs to be justified, such and such?
We had bosses who had vision and trust. And I've heard stories how my boss, the chief of the Division of Radiophysics, Bob Frater, had gone to the board of CSIRO and put forward these plans. And the board of CSIRO basically agreed with him, this is a good team, it's a real speculator, it's a flyer, but we should go for it. And they did. They funded us. And they did the same in the legal domain when they went after royalty returns from the various companies using the technology all around the world. And that ended up earning something like $400 million US for CSIRO, at least half of which went into funding young researchers around the country and future efforts, not just wireless, but across the board.
Yeah, I mean, that must be one of the best parts about it, I imagine, you know, knowing the legacy isn't this isn't just this incredible technology, but, you know, the money that's come from it has helped fund further scientists, further innovation, further research. That's got to be a great feeling.
Yes, it sure is. Yeah. Yeah. I guess in so many fields, you look at the young people and think, yeah, well, that's where the next steps are coming from.
Both James and I have little kids. What's your hope for them as far as education and, you know, as far as science and science literacy goes?
I personally feel strongly that we need all aspects of thinking, the arts, science. Many of the scientists and engineers I've known have been very, very interested in the arts. I would encourage anybody to be as broad as they can be, and encourage the interest in different things. And we have the potential now. It is really much easier to go and find out about something you didn't know anything about than it ever has been in the past. And it's really fun learning about new things. That was some of what school was about and university was about, learning about new things.
You know what makes it easy to learn about new things, John? Wi-Fi. I can't thank you enough for staying up late to talk to James and I. My final question, what's the name of your Wi-Fi network at your house?
The access point. It's a Telstra access point.
And John, of all people. See, we got to sort that shit out. Come on, John.
Raspberry Pis, multiple computers, TVs. I must be up to about 30 devices at this stage.
We'll try and come up with a great Wi-Fi name so when people are around for dinner at your place and they ask for Wi-Fi, they'll click on and they'll go, ah, there it is. That's got to be John's.
Suggestions gratefully received.
We'll be in touch.
You absolute legend. It's a complete honour to speak with you, mate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you see that? He has like 30 devices, Raspberry Pis. He's got Raspberry Pis at his house, Jimmy. That means he's got a shed. He's got a fucking shed.
Man shed.
That's like, can't talk to you, honey. I'm in the back. Tinker, 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 tinker.
He's very cheerful. It was lovely.
There's only one part about, like, he was a really cheerful man and it was really nice speaking to him. And I love that. I'd like to think that positivity was a part of what fueled his creative team as they went to discover things. There was only one thing about everything that he said that made me quite sad. He said at the very inception of network computing, the fastest connections they had between computers was fiber optics. And that was in the 70s and 80s. And here we are, James, you and me, trying to do it. Video calls. We don't have fiber optics.
You know what would be good? If we had like a national fiber optic network where everyone had fiber optic to their house. It means we could work from anywhere. Regional Australia could have access to super high speed internet. People would be able to get medical treatment, education, healthcare, entertainment, all from their home.
It'd change the media landscape too. It'd be fantastic. That's brilliant. We should pitch that.
Just an idea.
We should pitch that to someone. I really like that.
Just an idea. That's all I'm saying. Couldn't be too hard.
Surly Jim. I haven't seen Surly Jim in a while.
I've pushed Surly Jim down very deep.
Look, John, as you mentioned, he was not alone. According to Ars Technica, the other inventors of Wi-Fi were not only Dr. John O'Sullivan, it was Mr. Dirt Ostreet, Terry Percival, Dr. Terry Percival, who you mentioned, Mr. Graham Daniels, and Mr. John Dean. And those five people worked together to create this part of the technology that made Wi-Fi possible. They did it right here in Australia. It says here, by 2012, the royalties, because people then replicated it and they went, that's our patent. The way it works is like, oh, that's our patent. You're using our technology. Can we have some royalties, please? Yes, no problems. Over $430 million they made for the CSIRO.
Do you reckon John saw a cent of that?
I reckon John was pretty smart
with how he did things, Jimmy. I've got a feeling like if you come up with that, like whichever way you play it, if you came up with Wi-Fi 10 years before it became the standard, you probably figured a few things out.
You probably bought Bitcoin in 1999.
He is Satoshi Nakamoto. That's the other thing I forgot to tell you. He's Satoshi Nakamoto. Well, we started with Dolph Lundgren singing Eye of the Tiger, and we ended there with Dr. John O'Sullivan, one of the creators of Wi-Fi.
It's quite a journey. It was probably more convoluted than it needed to be. But look, hey, we talked at the beginning of the show, who needs linear?
How could I not talk to you about Dolph Lundgren going to the same university? How could I not go there?
I'm sure we watched Universal Soldier together, like on the road.
And the sequel.
But I love that. He's great. John's great.
He really is.
It's amazing that so much of the technology we use is just taken for granted. But there's these people beavering away. And you know what's different back then? And when you work for the CSRO, you're not some Silicon Valley hedge fund kid, you know? You're not trying to start some app to get a venture capitalist backing it to make your money and retire to the Bahamas. You know, that's so much of what is driving Silicon Valley. It isn't trying to improve people's lives. It's really just, how can we make money?
Yeah. The apps that we use every day are built by people like this.
You know, they were in it because they thought this could help people. This could advance society. There's something pretty awesome about that. I mean, there's almost a nobility in it, you know, doing science for the right reasons, not just trying to cash in on some sort of techno fad.
And we had a bachelor who, like, he started working in radio astronomy, all right? So they spend their time sitting around giant radio dishes listening to space, listening what space is making. And I asked the day I met Dr. Matt Agnew, who was our bachelor, who is the astrophysicist's bachelor, I'm like, what does it do for your perception as a human? What does it do for your perception of like all the things we think are so important down here to, you know, think about the scale? And he just went on this, his eyes just widened and he went, mate, you've got no idea. Once you realize that as far as we can see, as far as we can perceive is 64 billion light years. I think that's the right number, 64 billion light years away. But we know that there's stuff beyond that because things pop in from outside that spectrum because I am so infinitesimally small and everything is so meaningless. Like it must change the way you go through day to day going, I'm nothing. I am, as Carl Sagan would say, I'm a piece of stardust wandering around. I'm an atom contemplating another atom. I'm tiny. You know, it's got to change the way you look at the world.
Of course, you don't need to be an astrophysicist for that though. You know, you can do that. That should be your starting point. Every petty, pathetic, insular drama that you have in your life, think that you are, you know, a tiny collection of atoms on a rock floating in the middle of an infinite universe. How can you focus on these tiny problems? How can they have any importance? You're going to die. You'll be dead soon. No one will remember you in 100 years, you know? You wouldn't have. I'm not saying that nothing has value, but the things that we occupy our mind and our hearts and our time with, yeah, they don't matter so much. So just revel in the awesomeness that it is that you got to be alive. I don't know. That's my take anyway.
Are you feeling all right, mate?
I don't know. It's hard to know whether it's what's an existential crisis and what's just I'm really tired. You know, that's a game show that I pitched. It didn't really take off. Anyway.
Welcome to
You Know What I Mean?
Crisis. I know exactly what you mean, James. And I'm grateful. I'm very grateful I had the time to do this with you tonight. What are we going to talk about next time?
In the next few weeks, when you're talking to the man who captured the poo jogger.
Oh, my God.
Hopefully, we're going to talk to someone who was on the boat when Sally Robinson lay down her oars. And hopefully we'll do our very first listener request on Idle Australians. So hit us up. You got a story, you got a hero, you got an event, you got an invention, you got a flashback, got a bit of nostalgia that you want us to do a deep dive into, then we're here for you. Idle Australians at gmail.com.
You're a legend, James Weatherson. Have a good sleep. And I'll talk to you next time. This episode of Idle Australians was brought to you by me and James, who did the talking part. The audio production was by Daryl Misson. The research and production was by Bree Steele. And is there anything else we had to thank, James?
No, and I'm in two minds about giving credits.
Why?
Because one, I like the people who we work with to receive recognition. On the other hand, I enjoy people thinking that we do it all ourselves and that we pull this shit off single-handedly. And so...
You know what? In honor of our guest, this can be a quantum state of credits. It can be at the same time credits where other people help us make this show, and at the same time, in the same instance, in the same moment of time, no one else helps us make it. It's just us two. How about that?
Schrodinger's credits.
Bingo.
Who's going to listen to this show?
I'm so fucking nerdy. I love it.